Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding other people better, the things they do and the things they say. You can learn more about it and learn how to support this podcast at my site, peoplewhoreadpeople.com. As you may already know, sometimes on this podcast, I focus on topics related to political polarization, because I think that's a very important problem and one that doesn't get nearly enough attention. I recently released my second book on polarization. It's titled How Contempt Destroys Democracy, and you can learn more about that and my polarization work in general at american-anger.com. This episode you're watching will be one of the last episodes of my podcast in which I focus on political polarization. I'll mostly be returning to what the original theme of this podcast was, a focus on reading, understanding, and predicting human behavior in various contexts. I'll still work on polarization occasionally, but just to say I won't often focus on it for this podcast from here on out. If you want to stay up to date on my polarization-related work, please go sign up for my Substack newsletter, which you can get a link to from my website, american-anger.com. In this episode, I talk to two former congresspeople, Luke Messer, who is a Republican and who represented Indiana in the House of Representatives from 2013 to 2019, and Elizabeth Esty, who's a Democrat and represented Connecticut in the House of Representatives from 2013 to 2019. So they were both in the House for the same span of years. I talked to Luke and Elizabeth about polarization, about their experiences serving in a highly polarized environment, about their ideas for reducing political contempt and polarization, and more. Just to note that if you're listening to this on audio, this is a video chat. You can see the video of this talk on my People Who Read People YouTube channel. I want to thank Kara Jarzynski, the executive director of the Resolutionaries, for helping arrange this talk. And I also want to thank the United States Association of Former Members of Congress for their help in putting us in touch with Luke and Elizabeth. Okay, here's the talk with two former members of Congress. All right, I'm here with former Congressperson Luke Messer and Elizabeth Esty. And maybe we can start it out with, are there certain moments from your tenure that stood out to you as marking an increase in us versus them, toxic polarization? And maybe I can ask you that first, Luke.
Well, first, thanks for having us on the program. Great to see Elizabeth. We haven't seen each other in quite some time. We actually came into Congress together back in 2013 and left together in 2019 after both serving three terms. So while we weren't best of friends in Congress, certainly knew each other and thought well of each other, and have some common really good friends as well. So this should make for a fun conversation. Well, let me just kickstart it by telling you that sure, there is too much toxicity in Congress and too much partisanship. One of the events I observed happened in the very first days of entering Congress. And here's the story that I'm sure Elizabeth will be able to relate to. So when you first show up, it's kind of a pinch yourself moment. You've lived in this great republic your whole life, and you can't help but you know be excited by the opportunity to serve your friends and neighbors in Congress. And one of the first great events in those first few days is the opportunity to have dinner in Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C., right? That's the famous hall in the center of the Capitol where you have sort of the luminaries of American history and statue. And those dinners are, in your very first days, divided by party. It's not for any as nefarious a reason as you might expect. Essentially, the leader of the minority party and the Speaker of the House both have this extraordinary opportunity to court new members and to get them to vote for them. And so, by tradition, the minority leader hosts the Democratic new members when they come into the House, and the Speaker hosts, well, it depends on the year, but hosts the members of their party in the House. And you see sort of from the very first days you're in Congress, whether it's your caucuses meeting, your retreats that are divided, virtually everything is separated by party. And when you combine that with sort of the cable news culture that we live in, and, you know, we need to talk about as we get going, the fact that the reality of sort of partisan-based congressional districts is that often the constituents that sent you there didn't really send you there to get along. You know, it you know, sets us off in the wrong direction from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. As a real quick follow-up to that, I think because my audience is more liberal leaning, I think we often know about the things on the right that are, you know, perceived by on the liberal side as things Republicans have done that were divisive. But I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about things throughout the last couple of decades that especially stood out as divisive. For example, I was reading about the Bork nomination and how that was perceived by Republicans back in the day. And I'm curious if there are major things that are top of mind for you.
I need to follow up on that, but first I want to give Elizabeth the chance to say hello and kind of introduction, and then I'll be happy to answer that follow up.
Sounds good. Elizabeth,
well,
do you want
to, great. Sure. Great to be with you, Zach, and be with Luke as well, as we served together in the House. And I would totally agree with Luke. The sort of polarization and the separation starts even before actually you get sworn in. I remember we were at new member of Congress training together at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government in December of 2012. And a good friend, mutual friend of ours, Susan Brooks, who's from Indiana. Susan and I are about the same age, similar backgrounds, three kids, both lawyers. It turned out we were like wearing the same jacket one day. We bought clothes at the same place. And so we spent some time together and were featured in some, I can't remember, it was The Hill or some Politico, some discussion about what was going on with this big new class. 90 new members of Congress, 50 Democrats, 40 Republicans. So it was very divided, you know, it was fairly representative at that point. And we both caught flack from leadership about being too much fraternizing sort of with the enemy. And as you remember, Luke, the training that happens in the DC area was segregated by party. Again, this is prior to getting to Congress. So the Democrats had their own, like, getting ready for Congress training, explaining how committees work, explaining all these various, you know, details on the branches of government, but really the role of the House in this process. And that is divided by party. It's that training is not done together. So I would say, you know, that starts really early on, before you even get sworn in. So yeah, it's real. And I don't know that it was always that way. It's certainly been that way for a while. And I think it's regrettable, and you sit separated, you know, Democrats on one side, Republicans on the other, in all committees. And there's just a lot that is at this point fairly baked in, which is unfortunate. And I think makes it harder to do the people's business.
I think to the point, what's your podcast, Zach? So if you want to follow up, go ahead and do that.
Well, I was going to follow up something Liz said, but I do want to, I'll let you follow up about that question I asked you, Luke, if that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's, I think it's endangering our republic. I mean, I do. I think you're getting to the point where the inability for Washington to function is creating a dissatisfaction with the electorate that continues to send crazier and crazier, you know, environments to Washington with, you know, deteriorating results. And you know, as you mentioned, the listeners on your podcast probably aren't a whole lot of folks that might have ever voted for me. You know, I represent a relatively rural area of the 6th District of Indiana, 19 rural counties, which is where I grew up. So you wouldn't necessarily know some things about me. I rarely appear on TV since I've left Congress, in part because I don't want to kind of inject into some of this toxic environment. And I'm going to answer your question, and I'm going to just answer it sincerely. And you don't even have to agree with me, because I'm not speaking of the topic I'm going to talk to you about, asking you to agree with me. I'm just asking folks, particularly, like, I like to talk about the difference between big L liberal thinking and little L liberal thinking, right? Little L liberal thinking is just the willingness to consider broader thoughts beyond your own, right? And so, for example, there are a lot of folks on the left and in the center, and frankly, even some in the Republican Party, who've been critical of President Trump and his unwillingness to concede the election, to comply, you know, to admit to the fact that by certification of the electorate, his election was lost. And, you know, I'll tell you, my personal opinion is that were there irregularities in the 2020 election? Sure. Were they beyond the scope of the typical irregularities that we have in any American election over the course of the last 100 years? I haven't seen any evidence of that. The ballots were certified, and obviously Joe Biden was elected president of the United States. But I can also tell you, and again, I'm going to be sensitive and careful about how I say this, but, you know, during Joe Lieberman's eulogy, Al Gore made a note to the fact that he believes he still won the election. Now, did he go through all the legal barriers of Donald Trump? No, but by any fair measure of what Gore requested at the time, you know, even months later, neutral sources said, you know, Bush won Florida and onward we go. Now, again, because we kind of live in this kind of post-truth world, there were other studies that were done that went and asked for all kinds of other kinds of chads that might have been counted. And if you count ballots that included impressions for both and all kinds of things that under the standards of the law at the time, you wouldn't have been allowed. Somebody was able to come up with some scenarios where there were a few other, you know, potential of Gore winning by 300 votes there or something. I can tell you, I looked at the intelligence reports of the Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump election. And, you know, it's not particularly classified now, but I mean, under the standards of the investigations of the Obama administration, those reports said that the Russians enjoyed mucking around in our elections, and they didn't imagine that Donald Trump could even win. But there's really no evidence that their efforts impacted the results of the election, or that, frankly, they even wanted Donald Trump to win, because that's not what the intelligence showed. The intelligence showed that they just didn't want Hillary Clinton to win, and they thought it'd be fun to try to wreak havoc in our system. The reality is 8 years later, we've now got as a country a situation that are probably more than the Russians would have ever imagined when they were mucking around in the 2016 election. And all I'm saying to that is this, I'm not trying to equate Donald Trump's efforts to what some around Hillary Clinton did, or even with what Al Gore did, but we've gotten to this point as a system. There's an irresponsibility in bending the facts to fit our argument. And we are now on the back end of that, where the continual kind of evolution of that has a, you know, major party candidate 4 years after the election unwilling to admit that he didn't win. And frankly, most of the elected officials in his own party that aren't really willing to publicly talk about it out loud. And I think it's easy on the left to kind of see that in a vacuum and to, you know, sort of ignore that the deterioration of thoughts on our institutions around elections has been going on for a better part of a decade now.
Yeah, I think if I had to tie in what you're saying to my question, it's like people, and it's something I often talk about, people take the most pessimistic interpretation of things they find on the, you know, the other side. And, you know, no matter what you think of Trump, or, you know, no matter which side of that argument you're on, I think we can acknowledge that there are fundamental emotional, you know, toxic polarization dynamics that lead people to take the most pessimistic interpretations of things that happen that their political opponents do, right? And if we can acknowledge that, then we can start getting to the root cause of this and talk about that more. And that's what I focus on. Yeah.
Yeah. And Zach, I mean, look, here's the thing. I think I'm kind of funny because I live out here in Indiana in the middle of the country, and I come and have spent a lot of professional time in Washington, D.C. So I spend a lot of time in Indiana interpreting Washington, D.C. for Indiana, and I spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C., interpreting the middle of the country for folks back there. And I would just say, when you listen to folks, if, you know, if your listeners really want to think about, okay, is it possible that all those folks I disagree with aren't just bad people, that maybe they just see the world differently, you will hear them say, hey, man, what Trump's doing is no different than what Hillary Clinton did or what Al Gore did. And I can say, look, I can sit here as somebody who's trying to be a rational thinker, say, well, it is a little, it is different, but it's.
There's a divergence of narratives is what happens. You know, we filter the world through our preferred narratives. And I think there's a human aspect to that. That's what I focus on. It's like, no matter if you agree with X, Y, Z or don't, I think it's worth acknowledging that we can easily reach divergent narratives. Right. Elizabeth, I think I called you Liz. I think you want to prefer Elizabeth. Was that right?
That's right.
Okay. So I wanted to come back to what you said about the separation in Congress from the very beginning. Is that, and I've wondered about this, is it a very formal thing? Like, are you told to not associate with the quote other side, or is it more, do you face real repercussions or criticisms from many people if you do those things? And does it extend to even like working on bipartisan legislation? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, the pressures.
Sure. I would say it's more informal. I represented a swing district. Connecticut's 5th district is, as I like to say, the most favored party was the neither of your party's party. Now, more districts are like that now, but my district that at the time was 42% unaffiliated voters. And Connecticut has closed primaries. So that means people are giving up their right to even vote in a primary. So I take that as a really serious condemnation of the parties as representing people's views. And in the 2016 election, I had this somewhat surreal experience, which I do not think many of my, to Luke's point, many of my Democratic colleagues have, of going to the polls in a place like Waterbury, Connecticut, and having somebody decked out in full MAGA regalia, the hat, the t-shirt, you know, the sweatshirt, everything, hugging me at the polls, saying, you know, Elizabeth, we love you. You say what you mean what you say, no BS, although we use the full version. And that's why we're voting for you and Donald Trump. To which, as a politician, if anyone says they're voting for you, say thank you. And then you hope your thought bubble isn't showing, going like, what? But it was kind of to Luke's point, it was a question of, I had earned authenticity and trust. And I would say what I see is the big issue here really is trust. It's a breakdown of trust, societal trust, community trust. And that's been lit on fire with COVID, because people were no longer, you know, no more IRL, no longer living in real life. And that just amplified the divisions, the suspicion, the echo chambers. And as we know now, although it wasn't the intent, the way social media works, the funding of the internet and the way social media in particular works, it feeds on division and moving to the polls, right? That's what gets the clickbait is outrage. The clickbait is not puppies and rainbows. So we definitely, I'm sure Luke saw it, I certainly saw it during my time in Congress, of somewhat constituents, but even more so supporters wanting less and less compromise. They say they want compromise, but then you talk about an issue and like, oh, well, you can't compromise on that. Like, we sent you there to be doctrinaire. I'm like, no, I'm representing 750,000 people. And if you take that only about half vote, and of those, you get the majority of those who vote, it's really not that many people. And you have to be pretty humble about what kind of mandate you have. And you're trying to represent a very diverse, in my case, a very diverse constituency in a very diverse country at a very divided time. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty quaint, but I saw my job was to how to get to yes, how do I get deals done? And that's what I tried to do. So I got to know people. I intentionally went out of my way to go to every bipartisan thing there was. There was a, and here's part of how things die, right? There was a bipartisan dinner group that Lamar Smith was part of who was the Republican longtime member from Texas, Republican chairman of the Science Committee, which I was on. And he invited me to go to those dinners. And I, in turn, like, you had to bring a bipartisan buddy. Those things died after a couple of years. It just became too hard for people to make the time to do that and to get support for doing things like that. I was part of the Problem Solvers Caucus. We did do bipartisan legislation. I got tons of bills passed during my time because I learned the strategy of go high or go low. I was in the minority the entire time. So I was a Democrat in the minority in a very seniority bound caucus, right? The Democrats highly bound by seniority, particularly at the time I was there. And so the only way I was going to get anything passed was to work with committee Republican committee chairs, got a lot of power and could make it happen, or very vulnerable Republican members from districts like mine who were in swing districts, where, again, their leadership was going to want to help them get something passed. And as a result, I got tons of legislation passed. Well, I knew how to do that in part because I represented a Republican community on the local level and had figured out how to do that. I'd worked at the state legislature, been a representative. I'd learned to do that. We have more and more people getting elected who have never served in office, campaigned on, raised money on, raised their profile on, hell no, I will never give an inch. How in the world are you then going to give an inch? You don't even know what that means. Your leadership is either incapable of or not desiring of helping you learn how to do that. And incumbents used to win. They won not because of bringing home the bacon so much. They actually got things done. So I see one of the huge problems being over my lifetime. Congress has abdicated responsibility. Congress has gotten less and less functional, which has meant the presidency is more and more important. So it becomes all about the presidency. And I think that's part of why we've gotten this terrible position of fighting over the results of the presidency, because it is a complete winner take all. And the president decides everything, whether we go to war, how much money is spent, how, you know, we behave in the world, but also what actually happens domestically. And it always frustrated me that I couldn't get, you know, during my first 4 years, my Republican colleagues to say, look, you don't like what Barack Obama is doing, so let's make Congress more robust. Let's flex our muscles. Let's actually adopt budgets and decide things. And then, of course, when the shoe was on the other foot, it was quite clear Democrats were, you know, hysterically unhappy for a lot of good reasons in my mind about what Donald Trump was doing and how he was doing it and how divisive he was. But again, nature abhors a vacuum. Yeah. The country needs to be governed. And I think some of the blame really is on Congress itself. Like, if we aren't happy with this, Congress needs to do a better job. Mm-hmm. But it's hard because the incentives are not for that. The incentives are now highly, you raise money, get on TV, get attention, get out from under leadership by being a nutcase. And I don't have to name names. We all know some of the people we're talking about. To see, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene surrounded by 30 press in a picture saying, hell no, she's going to call up a vote on Mike Johnson. Like, that never would, like, that would have been so unimaginable 15 or 20 years ago. You'd have a fairly junior member in the party having a collection of 30 members of the press eating out of her hand, hanging on her every word. She loves it. And if you're not getting legislation passed, you're getting attention, you're getting on TV, you're getting, quote, the goodies that are available by, to my mind, misbehaving, by not cooperating, by not passing legislation, by not doing the hard work of compromise. So the incentives are terrible now.
Luke, did you want, I was going to ask a question.
Well, I mean, look, it's, of course, easier for each of us to cite folks across the other side of the aisle, but there's folks that have made themselves famous with similar approach on both sides. I know Elizabeth agrees with that. Zach, this is like such an important topic that you're talking about. And there are really giant global phenomenon that are part of this. There are, I think, some really big, important principles that are part of this. And then there's some really small tactical problems in Congress that are part of it. And it all comes together. And I'll try and
many factors.
Two 2 minutes go through kind of those three, and then we can go wherever you're most interested. But one, I think it's important to realize this kind of like defiance of large institutions and this sort of populist rising, and it's not just an American phenomenon, it's an international phenomenon. It's happening all over the globe, and it's happening largely because the big institutions of the world have failed their people. And so you have a lot of folks who are angry and upset, and they don't know who to blame, so they blame who's in charge. And I think part of the challenge we all face, and one of the things you have to be careful of when you have these conversations, is, yeah, I think that the loss of truth in our country, the loss of civility in our governing systems is it's important. The danger is dire, and we need to fix it. And yet we have to at least acknowledge that to a whole lot of folks out there, that just sounds like, hey, go, you just want to go be nice. I mean, I can tell you of a story when I was running for the U.S. Senate. Someone came up to me and said, you know, Messer, I like you. You seem like a good person. You seem like you're right on the issues, but you're not angry enough. You're just not angry enough. And I said to them, you know, hey, you know what? Like, I've gotten plenty angry in my life. I'm an old middle linebacker, and I've never solved a problem by being angry. Right? You got to go move through. And I was really proud of my answer, and I lost my election by 20 points in 3 months. Right? Like, so, but people are angry for a reason. And I think, unfortunately, this kind of pushback on institutions has ended up being a pushback on civility and even truth. Right? We sort of grew up with the, I don't know how many of your listeners will know the old sheepdog and coyote cartoons, right? Where they would go after each other all during the cartoon. And at the end, after, you know, trying to blow each other up and push each other off cliffs, they would clock out from their job and then walk away kind of talking to each other about their kids. And there's something about that approach that just feels false to people, right? And I think we need to kind of better understand and help promote why that's important for our system to work. And then on the complete other side of this, and I think Elizabeth will agree with this, the rule structure is so leadership driven in the House that essentially it takes a majority vote of a vote of your entire caucus to get a bill of any controversy to the floor. So like, part of the baffling debates, particularly on the Republican side of the last 6, 8, 10 years, has been, well, the extreme element of the caucus voted down the rule, and therefore the House is in chaos. Well, the whole reason that can happen is that our rules are so convoluted in the House chamber that you essentially have to pass a piece of legislation waiving all of the rules to get a bill on the floor. If you actually had rules that you followed that empowered the pen, that let an individual member of Congress push the institution, then you would have, I think, a much more functioning body. And you know, here's the reality, is that may sound like a dream world, but it's a dream world that functions in most state legislatures and city councils across America. I mean, in almost every other deliberative body, you can push a controversial matter to the floor and vote as a body. And essentially the argument the leadership will give you is, oh, we're spending billions and trillions of dollars here, and the issues are so complex that we could never have a rule structure that let individual members push legislation. Here's the reality, right, is if you do that in those systems on city councils and state legislatures across America, it's not only members of the majority party that get to push the institution, it's members of the minority party as well. And I believe, and I mean, again, I don't mean to sound like a Pollyanna, I just, in some ways, it's pretty pessimistic, but part of what's happening is people keep sending the next wave of leaders to make a change. And they show up in a body where it's virtually impossible as a new member to push really meaningful change, and nothing happens. And so, you know, the analogy you will often hear on the Republican side about Trump, okay, and I'll try to get to it fast, is they'll describe the story of you've got bats in the attic, and people keep showing up, and nothing happens in the attic, and the bats stay there. And finally, this kind of smelly, awful looking person shows up, and they go up in the attic and the bats are gone. You know, I need somebody just to take care of the bats in the attic. And it's become, frankly, on both sides, this sort of the louder, the more vitriolic person we can send, we're going to send them there because the house needs cleaned out because all those people are bad people. And I would be curious to see if what Elizabeth's reaction is to what I'm about to say. In my farewell speech, I made a point to my constituents and, you know, for what it's worth, to history, I guess, that I didn't meet one person in my time in Congress who I honestly thought was trying to destroy America. I didn't meet one person. I met plenty of people who I thought had ideas that if their ideas were successful would be really bad for America. But the people I met in Congress were largely, even the people I districted most, and I think even some of the people who light their hair on fire and stand in front of the TV actually believe they're trying to do the right thing for America. And I think it's important we don't forget that.
Maybe that's a good place to segue into. I was wondering about this Building Civic Bridges Act that I've read about. What are your thoughts on that, Elizabeth? I'll start with you. Do you know much about that?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of things that can and should be done. I think if you look how little Republican co-sponsorship you have on that bill, you'll see what the likelihood is of that happening. I think we need an all of the above strategy, as we do, for example, on climate change. We need to do a little bit of a lot of different things, or frankly, a lot of different things. And I think it would be helpful to have some actual examination into like what actually works. But again, it's to rebuild trust. Like, you tend not to be vitriolic with people right in front of you, right? It's the anonymity of the internet has encouraged that, the people not seeing the other people as actual people. So the anonymity, I think, has become really poisonous and has allowed people to say things. I would say to, for example, members of my staff or my kids who were upset about something that was posted online, I say, look, you're reading the bathroom wall. Did you read the bathroom wall in middle school and high school? Don't read it. Like, I just didn't do social media for that reason. I suggested things to my staff, but I saw colleagues, I'm sure Luke did too. We have, you know, colleagues and friends who'd spend half their time, you know, busy online, tweeting about stuff, snarky little memes, whatever, because they got lots of support for that, right? And that's not actually, I would say, doing the job, the rather boring and laborious job of passing legislation, which is in theory the principal job of Congress, is to do that, which is slow and it entails compromise. Mm-hmm. And good ideas may take a long time to percolate up, and you may only get not even half a loaf, maybe you get a third of a loaf. But that's still better than nothing if you've done it in a bipartisan way, which is the only way to get anything done that's going to last, is in that way. So I think, you know, there, as I couldn't agree with Luke more about the rules of the House, which completely, and the same thing largely true on the Senate too, it's become very difficult to get legislation passed, and it's become just sort of a partisan power play, as opposed to saying, like, look at that. I will use an example of something that was immensely frustrating during the time I was in Congress. The immigration reform. I don't know, Luke, where you were on that, and you probably were where your district reflected, but I had a lot of growers and farmers in my district who very much wanted immigration reform because they couldn't get enough labor to work the fields and to milk the cows in my district. So we had the votes for sure. If that immigration reform bill had been passed up, it would have called up, it would have passed for sure, but not with a majority of majority votes, which is what's referred to as the Hastert rule in the Republican side. And so it was really frustrating to see this unwritten rule that had been part of sort of retaining power again, and Luke and I are in agreement, leadership of the parties. The power has been concentrated in the leadership of the party. It's all about who has the gavel, who has the speaker's gavel. That decides the committees. Committees don't have much power anymore. The committees used to have a lot of power. And there were reasons why that changed. I mean, it changed after Watergate. It changed because it was a lot of old white men, often from the South. There were pressures that made that change. But the net result is it concentrated power in the speaker. Newt Gingrich was very effective at doing that. So is Nancy Pelosi. So this is like, it's not just one party, right? It's not just one party that's found that, you know, you have effective ability to whip votes when you have a strong speaker, but the net result is you get less and less legislation passed that can endure. Because the only legislation that's going to endure is things that are bipartisan. That's the only way it's going to happen. And right now, when we're so divided, and I would say Congress is as much a reflection of the division in the country, it's not just people being disagreeable, to Luke's point. It's people really genuinely have different views. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't be surprised that Congress reflects very different views because people's lives are different. I would just like to see more reminding and starting meetings and starting discussion about our shared values. Like, start with the values and then work towards the programs. Because if you can, I think we tend to jump to the programs and take that as a surrogate for the values. They're not. Like, people who voted against immigration reform don't hate immigrants largely. They may have different views of what security means at the border, what the steps should be to become an American citizen. But we use a lot of really strong language that calls into question the morals and the values of the other side. And that makes it almost impossible to get things done. And I'd love to see us return to an assumption and treating other colleagues in the elected body as like, can we, I think we can all agree on, you know, X, Y, Z. Here's how the programs I think would advance that value. And I just think that language terminology would help. I used it in town halls a lot, and I needed to. My district included the Sandy Hook School. Those shootings happened while we were in new member of training at the Harvard Kennedy School in December of 2012. So I had to deal with those gun issues all the time I was in Congress. In a district where they make guns, there are a lot of hunters. I had to have armed police in all of my town hall meetings the entire time I was in Congress. Now everybody does, but at that time it was pretty rare. But I was able to deal with that by reminding people we're here not to agree, but to participate in democracy and to respectfully hear each other and to try to come to some decisions. And I think we have to model that. I think citizens have to model that, that respectful engagement.
Yeah, yeah, I think, go ahead. Yeah, I was going to follow up about the Civic Bridges Act, but go ahead, Luke.
Yeah, so I mean, look, I think the challenge, and Elizabeth alluded to it, I've got some pretty conservative friends that are on that bill, but I would also say it's probably most Republicans are going to be skeptical of the fact that we can create a government agency or a government study that is somehow going to address the problem. And so just consistent with your philosophical belief, it's not that they don't want to see more civility or, you know, focus on truth. I think that makes that effort a challenge. I think it's important to say about the leadership. The leadership are responding to the incentives in front of them as well. I think Elizabeth agrees with that. I think people aren't, it's not that they're bad people in leadership. It's just that we've kind of come to this point of view where it all has to be, you know, it's shirts and skins, it's red and blue, it's whatever, you know, metaphor you use, you're pushing the team. And it's interesting, even the most provocative members on the left and the right who are saying, I need to be able to come here, I need to be able to push the institution. If you really listen to them, they also want their leadership to keep stuff off the floor they don't like. Does that make sense? So it's like, hey, I want smart stuff, but I mean, don't let that immigration bill come to the floor. Don't let that bill on a, you know, on pro-life issues come to the floor. I don't want to have to vote on that. And so the reality of freeing up the rules to let an individual member happens, you know, it means like as a Republican, if somebody wants to put up a $25 an hour national minimum wage, they'd have the ability to do that. If somebody wanted to put forward legislation that restricted certain, you know, limits to abortion, they'd have the ability to do that. And so, you know, don't get me wrong, it's not as if there's no controversy, but in our system, you're sent there to vote on these issues. Vote the way that you believe for your constituents, and then move forward. And then I think, you know, it's important to say, and Elizabeth alluded to it, remember, most of these members, this is the thing none of us want to own. Most of these members are far more thermometer than thermostat. Okay. They are going there reflecting the points of view. And I would just challenge a little bit, you know, some of your listeners, how much did my conversation about Hillary Clinton in the election and Al Gore in the election make your blood boil? How much were you like, I can't believe he believes those things and equates those things? You know, look, the reality is this, is that civility and truth, it starts with the fact that you're not going to attack the people you disagree with. And that's changed a lot since even in the 6 years that Elizabeth and I've left the chamber. You know, it is still a rule on the House floor that you cannot openly challenge the motivations behind a member for their, that's a rule. And sometimes if you violate it, your words will be taken down and there will be a vote about whether you challenge it. It's that way for a reason, right? Because if we can say you're a lousy communist, you know, as shooting down your argument, one, I mean, there used to be like fights and even gunshots on the floor they were trying to avoid. But much more fundamental to that, like, if we deteriorate to the point of view that the other side's evil, then we don't have to listen to anything that they have to say.
Right.
And I think all of us have to check ourselves and understand that this system isn't going to work very well if we don't, you know, agree with that. And then secondly, you know, most of us, I overuse the sports analogies in life, but, you know, if you're a basketball player, the free throw line's 15 feet away. The 3-point line is 20 feet or so or more, depending on where you're there. You don't move it to 13 and 16. You know, the boundaries are the boundaries. If you step on the line, you're out of bounds. You know, we've gotten to the point of view on both sides that, you know, whatever I have to do to bend the facts to make my argument is fair game, because, you know, what's more important is winning the argument than maybe losing today.
Right.
You know, I remember Elizabeth probably had a similar circumstance. I remember the first time I ever saw my words quoted in a language I didn't understand, like a foreign language that I did not understand what I was saying. And it was sobering, because I realized that, like, the world was listening to the members of Congress here and what they have to say. And so I was, through the rest of my career, a little more careful about how I trashed the other side or what I said about our institutions. You know, and if you've listened to leaders in this country over the last 12 years, I mean, it's no wonder that the rest of the world thinks America is behaving like a banana republic. Because to listen to our rhetoric, we are. I mean, we're a lawless place where elections are decided based on whims of whoever happens to be in charge. We have leaders who are evil, and you know, we ought to calm ourselves down a little bit.
Well, I think
country and for the world.
Yeah, I think at some level we do have to come to terms with the fact that it's very easy for groups of people to get into these very different narratives and worldviews and reach completely different stances on things, even if you think they're very wrong, even if you think they're doing harm. It's just a fundamental fact that it's just so easy for us to disagree on so many things. And I think, you know, that's one thing I was going to say with regards to, you know, one of the solutions to this is just people need to talk more about this problem and about our distorted, overly pessimistic views of each other. But the incentives are not there. For example, in order to talk about the problem of our distorted perspectives and polarization, it requires to even talk about that is a indirect admission that, you know, my group has something to work on, or I have something to work on. So even by talking about the problem, you know, can seem like people just don't want to do that, because it involves like, oh, that means I'm saying it's not just their fault. It's also something we're doing. Yeah. And all the incentives internally and externally, we just don't want to behave those ways emotionally and for the external incentives. So I just think about that in terms of, there's just these incentives that work against political leaders even talking about the problem, which is kind of like the nature of conflict. Like, conflict creates an environment where people don't even want to talk about solving the root causes of the conflict. And yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there.
Two quick thoughts there, Zach. I mean, Elizabeth and I can both in part be on this and have this conversation with you because I don't speak for Elizabeth, but neither one of us are particularly interested in running for office again. Okay. So I don't Correct. Have to care if somebody doesn't like it and thinks I'm a little soft because, the reality is I think the future of our country matters more than whatever small glimmer of me ever running again. And then secondly, with the risk of, oversimplifying a very complicated issue. I mean, I know we had issues in overloading of hospitals. There was a lot more to it than what I'm about to describe. Okay. But think through, I was in a unique situation during COVID. I lived in Northern Virginia at the time, right as it happened. My family was back in Indiana. You had sort of the classic coastal response to COVID in Virginia. Everything was shut down. People wore masks everywhere. Schools were closed. Back in Indiana, it was more or less pretty open and schools were open and people wore masks, but it was a much more lenient point. My they didn't have football season in Virginia. My son and I distinctly remember going to my nephew's football game back in Indiana, and people would hold their hands over their face talking to us while Hudson and I were wearing masks coming from Northern Virginia. I say all that to say, Zach, like, we were all so angry at each other and so certain we were right, right? We were ready to end friendships and like scream at family because we were right. And now the science afterwards is more or less that both places behaved about the same. The timing was a little different in when COVID rolled out, right? And we don't really talk about that very much. But it's part of why folks on the coast are so convinced that those people in the middle of the country are crazy and they don't get it. And people out there in the middle of the country think, well, you guys all put on all those masks and tied yourself in knots. And, yeah, we had some issues too, but that wasn't any of that.
Luke, I think that's a great example, though, of where we could do a real service to restore trust, to say, like, let's look at what really happened. Like, people were trying to save lives. And there was stuff we didn't know when things were changing. That's the way science works. And frankly, that's the way politics should work too. We learn things. Like, we have objectives, we have goals. Like, does anyone want more poverty? No, we'd all like less poverty, right? Well, let's see how our programs are working. How much progress are we making? What is working? Let's do more of what's working, less of what's not. And things change over time. And I really would love to see more of that approach about legislation as a whole. Let's talk about our objectives. We agree on our objectives. Maybe we can even agree on benchmarks. Then we vote and we go with whatever program gets the most votes. And then we look back in a couple of years and 5 years, what's working, what's not. But we don't refight the goal, right? And I think the problem is we kind of substituted the programs become the goal. So I became very frustrated with my colleagues because I saw some of your questions, Zach, would say like, oh, the Republicans hate poor people because they had questions about welfare programs and stuff. And I said, like, look it, I've got really poor people in my district. They have a lot of reason to say you've had this war on poverty for 50 years. How come we have so many poor people still? How come we have people who still need to get food assistance? Maybe we could do better. I don't think that's heretical. But certainly in parts of the Democratic Party, it was heretical to have those views, right? And so I have the small hope, very small, that if we could do an examination of what happened in COVID over time, mm-hmm. and be honest in talking about what we knew and what we didn't. And I think that's part of a problem for leadership right now. People are very reluctant to ever say they don't know. And frankly, the public doesn't reward you generally for saying you don't know, but often you don't know is the right answer, right? And it would be better if we could have more leaders say, I don't really know. I'm not sure. This is my best guess for now. But as we get more information, we can go back and keep refining it. So rather than saying it's like a fixed point, yay, I've fixed poverty, or like I've solved COVID, you know, no more problems at the border. It's like, no, these are ongoing, evolving issues. We're going to keep at them. And that's just a very different mentality to take to it. And it's much more what families do, you know, what companies do, certainly what science does. It's like you keep at it. And some of your hypotheses, some of your efforts fail. New Coke, big disaster. Like, but Coke didn't go bankrupt, right? Try again. Let's try something else. What does the market really want? And I feel like part of the frustration, and Luke is absolutely right. I spent the last 2 years out of the country, mostly in Geneva, Switzerland. My husband was working for one of the big UN agencies. And this is all over the world, you know, this kind of unrest, populism, for a lot of reasons. You know, some of it is income inequality, dramatic changes in, you know, social media pressures, information sources. Again, the pandemic really historically have led to conspiracy theories and social unrest. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why we see what's, and migration, worldwide migration is putting lots of governments under stress. So we are not alone, but we do have a disproportionate role to play as America. I think America does have, I think, a world leadership role, not just in safeguarding peace, but in being a beacon of democracy. And that pains me greatly to see us acting in very undemocratic ways with uncivil language that discourages engagement and discourages real progress towards doing better for people, helping their lives be better, which is kind of the point of democracy.
Are you all okay with a few more minutes?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. I wanted to ask, with a few remaining minutes, I was curious to ask, let's imagine you had, you know, complete power to pass or do the things you want to do in America. Are there certain changes you'd make, a specific systemic change you'd make, or something else to try to reduce the toxicity of our divides? I realize that's a broad question. And also, Luke, I do want to say, when it comes to understandable conservative skepticism about, you know, governmental changes to reduce polarization, I've seen that in the depolarization space. I've seen conservatives who want to reduce polarization, but they're skeptical of, you know, of the governmental approach, and they much prefer more grassroots social change approach, which I understand, because that's in fitting with their philosophies. But yeah, having said that, are there things that come to mind for you, whether it's like changes to media environment or something else that you'd really like to see done?
Well, that's a whole nother hour long podcast, I think, but I can tell you, I'm going to say something that probably seems, you know, unlikely to happen. But civility, I think the thing we have to watch with civility can sound a whole lot to people like complacency. And people don't want complacency. They want change. I just think you're not going to have change if we don't, you know, get focused on as leaders, a civility that, you know, and this, I'm a person of faith, so I'm going to use the words grace and truth, right? Grace is the idea that, hey, I'm imperfect and I suspect you're imperfect too, and I'm not going to assume the worst about you. I'm going to try to figure out where we have common ground. And then some understanding that they're just the truth. I mean, you know, Elizabeth brought up earlier, global warming. Well, the temperature of the earth is warming. It is. That's a fact. It's true. And now the next level of truth is starting to examine why and what can be done to do that, and weighing that off against other things that also matter in a society that has to function and keep people alive and grow an economy and all of that. But you do have to start the debate with the understanding of that fact, that it's the truth. Right. And frankly, back to my point about Congress being a thermometer, not a thermostat, right? Instead of changing the temperature, it reflects the temperature of the people. We're going to need, as a society, to be a society that brings a little more grace and a little more civility and a little more truth. And I'm not as pessimistic as some as that can happen, right? Maybe in some ways that's the new rebel approach to life that, you know, can start to emerge. And you see that in other sectors as well. That and a few rules changes in the House, and I think we'd be a little better off.
Elizabeth, do you, if you had your, you know, if you had power, are there some, a major change you'd make that comes to mind?
Well, you know, I think there are a number of things. The Electoral College, I think, has ended up being problematic at this point, but that's not going to change. And I understand that for a lot of reasons. But I do think, you know, it was a creation of the time to recognize, you know, a lot of compromises that were made at the time of the founding of the country. We have abilities to do things, and we also don't just restrict voting to free white landholding men. We've made a lot of other changes. So I would love to, you know, I think that could help turn some of the temperature down, and but maybe not. And it's not going to happen anyway. I'd love to see, as a practical matter, I think the House itself could make some changes. I really do. And actually, I think there was some value to having the Republicans having limited the tenure in committee chairmanships, probably a little bit longer, might have made sense for some of the like ways and means or some of the things where more experience is valuable. But I think that might be something that the Democrats should think about, so that you don't require people to be around for 20 years to begin to have leadership roles. I don't think that's good incentive structure. I think rules can and should be changed. And there definitely were a number of bills out of the Modernization of Congress Committee, which did a lot of really good work, that would do things like prioritize bills that have a certain percentage of bipartisan support, that if you could get, and it wouldn't require 218, it wouldn't be like what's called the discharge petition, which requires that a bill be brought up. But it would be a lower threshold, but nevertheless a very significant threshold of bipartisan support that would be able to bring bills to the floor. And yes, it would be uncomfortable votes for vulnerable members, but you're sent there to do a job. And I think we need to get back to the business of passing legislation. I was always a big fan of national service. I have a lot of veterans in my committee, in my constituency. And I found that when I talk to them, you know, a 96-year-old Italian-American from Waterbury, Connecticut, who the first Black person they met was somebody they served with in the military, and how life-changing that was for them, and how much they understood being American and the diversity of the country. I don't think we should restrict that kind of collective experience and that glue and that experience of working together on something greater than yourself, which is what I'd love to see. I've always been an advocate for national service. I think there's tons of stuff that needs to be done in the US, whether it's helping out in schools with kids with literacy issues or environmental cleanups or tending to parks or helping, frankly, in senior citizen centers. And there's just a lot of things that could be done in America that I think in some ways asking more of our young people.
And you get to know very different people too, which is fundamentally depolarized.
Exactly. And have people see the power of collectively working together, not because they agree on everything, but because there are common goals, to develop that respect. I do think trust is the big issue. And I think that has to be done in person. And I would hope that the Congress figures out ways to do that. Certainly January 6th and COVID tattered a lot of the trust within the Congress. That's what I hear from friends on both sides of the aisle, how much that tattered their trust of each other. I used to go to the gym every day. That's how I got my intel about what was happening in Congress and how I got, frankly, most of my co-sponsors. Well, I know people who stopped going to the gym because folks were not wearing masks, and there were some older members or people who had immunocompromised family members who just said, like, I can't do this anymore. And then they stopped going. So I do think rebuilding of trust is a slow process, but it's possible. It's possible in marriages that have gone through challenging times. It's got to be possible in the country. I wouldn't have gotten involved in politics if I weren't a fundamental optimist that we can and need to do better. America's been through tough times before. We made it through the Civil War. I think we can do this here, and I'd still put my money on America more than any other country, given all the problems in the world. Still rather be here with the tools we have, the people we have, the ingenuity, the creativity. And I think it's reminding people that that is what binds us, this belief in a common, better future. And that that, if we turn more towards that, we might be able to get farther.
I agree. And one, thank you, Elizabeth, for spending this time. And Zach, you know, I would just say to your listeners, you know, we all have to take responsibility for the role we play in this. You know, I just started something called the Indiana Business Healthcare Collaborative. The most important word in the organization is collaborative. It's an effort to try to bring together people throughout that sector. Not everybody's going to create some organization like that. But I'll tell you, with every tweet we forward, with every meme we send to our friends, every time we honk the horn at somebody that kind of cut us off a little bit, you know, the times that we're a little rude with the person who you know, they're not in charge of the kitchen. They just brought you the food and you got to yell at them. Like the all caps posts on Facebook, like we've all got to bring the temperature down. Mm-hmm. And if we each do that, you watch, we're going to end up seeing slightly different leaders and we'll be a significantly different country. And I think it's important. It's in one of the real keys to our future.
Yeah. And that's what I focus on that in my work, that we have to think about how we contribute to these things. And to quote an organization I work with, they're called Starts With Us, because they do focus on, you know, it's hard to change other people, but we can, you know, focus on ourselves. That's kind of the low hanging fruit, and seeing how we contribute, seeing how our political peers contribute. I just want to thank you both for your time. It's a big honor to talk to you both, and appreciate the open discussion.
Well, thanks, Zach, and great to see you, Luke, and take care.
Thank you. Bye.
That was a talk with Luke Messer and Elizabeth Esty, both of whom served in the House of Representatives between 2013 and 2019. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can learn more about it at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. You can learn more about my polarization-related work at american-anchor.com. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.